Support comes from Mosby Building Arts, upgrading windows to help curb appeal and keep homes efficient. More at callmosby.com.
This is St. Louis on the Air from St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Elaine Cha. The historic old courthouse in downtown St. Louis will reopen to the public this Saturday. That's the massive green-domed structure in front of the Gateway Arch that was modeled after the dome of St. Peter's Basilica in Vatican City. The old courthouse is the site where Dred and Harriet Scott sued for their freedom in 1847 and 1850, a case that ultimately reached the U.S. Supreme Court and upheld slavery. It was also the site of the 1872 case brought by Virginia Minor and her husband. That case would also reach the U.S. Supreme Court, where justices ruled that women were citizens but didn't have the right to vote. In a moment, we'll talk about this weekend's grand reopening celebration, but we first want to center one of the main reasons the courthouse is historically important, and that's the case of Dred and Harriet Scott. To do that, we're going to travel 7 miles north of the old courthouse to Calvary Cemetery, the final resting place of Dred and Harriet Scott. In 2023, a new monument was placed there that befits their legacy. My colleague, afternoon newscaster Marissa Ann Lewis-Thompson, spoke at that time with the Scots' great-great-granddaughter, Lynn Jackson, at the cemetery. Jackson is also the founder and president of the Dred Scott Heritage Foundation. For more, here's Marissa Ann.
There is only one word that comes to mind when you first see the new Dred Scott Memorial Monument. Stunning.
The front of it is reminiscent of a courthouse. And that's what my original thought was, that, you know, the fact that he's at the top means that he was able to rise above the law within his own heart and by the good help of those who helped him throughout the 11 years of his trial.
That's Lynn Jackson. She's Scott's great-great-granddaughter and the mastermind behind the 9-foot-tall black granite monument tucked away in St. Louis's Calvary Cemetery. Scott's name is held up by 5 pillars that tell pieces of his story.
The center column has an image of him, which is from the charcoal drawing. That is a family heirloom, probably the only real one we have. His date and just a synopsis of the fact that he and his wife sued for their freedom, and that this is his final resting place here at Calvary, that this was also one of the worst Supreme Court cases ever rendered. On the left is a tribute to his wife and daughters who are buried at Greenwood, and another individual is buried here with Dred Scott, which is a grandchild.
There's also a scripture and an excerpt of the Declaration of Independence. On the back, there's more history about the Scots, an excerpt from Dred's obituary, and a quote from Frederick Douglass.
He may decide and decide again, but he cannot reverse the decision of the Most High. He cannot change the essential nature of things, making evil good and good evil. Happily, for the whole human family, their rights have been defined, declared, and decided in the court higher than the Supreme Court.
The monument has been years in the making. Jackson says there was a lot that led up to it.
Merely the fact that the first one didn't tell you who he really was. It said that he fought for his freedom and that his friend Taylor Blow freed him, but there wasn't space to say very much. So I was very much interested in being able to tell more about why Dred Scott was important, as well as it was small and hard to see. As you look around where we're sitting, you know, they're all pretty much ground level. It's hard to have found it. I myself drove by and couldn't see it from time to time. So this one I wanted people to see, because his is among the top 3 that are asked for in the cemetery, which has over 300,000 people in it.
What were some of the roadblocks that you might have faced trying to get this whole thing together? I can see you were like...
Well, COVID was one, because, again, I've had this idea for several years. But when COVID hit, I thought, wow, we were going to have a fundraiser, and it got canceled because 2 weeks before everything got shut down. And I thought, okay, what can we do? Why don't we start trying to plan for the memorial and do a GoFundMe? And so that's how it got started. So it was a bit of a roadblock in that it was not a good time to have a fundraiser, but we found a fundraiser that worked.
Why do you think Dred Scott's story is a significant part of U.S. history, particularly to Missouri and Illinois history?
Well, his case is important because if he had not fought for 11 years, then who knows? There would not have been a Dred Scott decision. You had to go through the Missouri Supreme Court to get to the U.S. Supreme Court. And after 6 years, most people would have said, okay, I'm done. You know, but they tenaciously continued. And without that, who knows? The Civil War, of course, was a major outcome of that. But we still may have had slavery into the 1900s.
So, of course, we are here for Dred. And Dred is typically the focal point of the story. How does his wife Harriet's legacy play a role in this larger story?
She herself filed for freedom separate from Dred. They did it at the same time, on the same day, in the same place, but she had her own case. And that's something a lot of people don't realize, how important that was. Her opportunity to get freedom would have covered her daughters, because so goes the mother, so goes the child. And yet, had anything happened to Dred, and she didn't have a case, they would not have had a chance. In this situation, if anything happened to him, then she and her daughters still had an opportunity for freedom.
As his great-great-granddaughter, how does your family talk about this history? And are there other stories about his life that you remember hearing about?
When we were younger, we didn't sit around chatting about it. When holidays or notable days came, then we would see recognitions, or my dad and his brothers would be a part of it. But over the years, you know, things changed. You know, they were born in the 20s, and they had to live through times when blacks weren't given much credence. So now it's a lot easier for us to talk about our history, and I just felt inspired to make that happen.
Do you remember the first time you visited your great-great-grandfather's gravesite? And I'm curious about what that experience was like for you.
I don't really remember the first time I visited, but there's a picture of the first time. And the first time, there was no headstone there, but we were being shown where he was buried, which is right here where we're sitting. And that was a pivotal moment in history when his grave was recognized and then soon would be marked. So I have pictures of the first time I was here, but I can't say honestly that I remember standing here.
When you look at those pictures, what goes through your mind?
That my mom and dad and my brother and I were fortunate enough to be here and know. We didn't understand, as my brother and I were just little kids. We were under four. But my parents and my dad, who actually carried on the legacy, were, I'm sure, very honored to have been able to stand here and be in Ebony magazine and say, wow, this is a historic spot. And soon it's going to be marked with a headstone.
I'm talking with Lynn Jackson, the great-great-granddaughter of Dred Scott. We're here in Calvary Cemetery at the site of Scott's new memorial monument. So you are the founder and president of the Dred Scott Heritage Foundation. Why was it important for you to maintain the legacy of Dred Scott?
Too many of our stories go unheard and unheralded and unknown. Mine was not such a story, and yet there's so much of it that was unknown. And yet, again, I want to encourage people to study their own history. So if my story can help someone else care about their own story, that's a personal thing for me. But nationally, it's just important to say, you know, look, we relegated this man in history. There was a time in the early 1900s when a book was published about African-American history, and he is not in it. It was a pivotal moment in history, the Dred Scott decision. I call it the linchpin of our nation's history, because things turned radically after the Civil War, and because of the Civil War, which was partly because of the Dred Scott decision, which was partly because they didn't give up. So I think it's just critical that we not forget people like Dred and Harriet and so many others.
So for years, people have continued to visit Dred Scott's grave. What is it about him and his story that you think draws people to it?
The courage to fight the system, it was sometimes considered seditious to sue your master. And yet in Missouri, the law once free, always free gave them the right to do that, but you still had to step out and do that. So that's one aspect of it. But then the rest of it for me is the continuance of it. I usually tell young people, like, hey, you just got your license and you're going to go out and kick it. Well, you get a ticket and now you've got to wait 2 weeks to go to court. Can you imagine waiting 11 years to get an answer under the circumstances under which they lived? So every bit of it had to do with courage and endurance.
How do you hope this monument will further teach people of all ages about who he was, especially at a time where talking about Black history in this country has been contentious, like talking about this history, and this is your family lineage.
Okay, so we have the Dred Scott Heritage Foundation, which was founded on three principles: commemoration, education, and reconciliation. This monument encompasses all three of those ideals. And in particular, I'm hoping for reconciliation to be a part of what comes out of this, because as a lot of people don't realize it, there were many abolitionists and many people who were not African-American who helped Dred and Harriet throughout their whole ordeal. And without them, they probably would not have made it to the Supreme Court. And so this monument encompasses everything that our work stands for. And I think when people come and see the inspiration that's on here, they will walk away with something they didn't have when they came.
You and your family have spent many years maintaining the legacy of Dred Scott. How do you hope it will be maintained once it's time to pass the torch to a new generation?
When my father wondered who would pass this on after his generation, he didn't know. And actually, I didn't know either. I had no clue I was going to be doing this as late as 2003, but I knew the anniversary would be in 4 years. And so I said, well, you know, we'll do something for sure, because I've always been a planner and a manager and so forth. So I said, well, we were not going to sit back and just watch it on TV, but I did not know. And I had no idea that I was destined to continue and continue. So I'm only believing that down the road, another person can pick up the banner.
How do you hope people remember your contributions to Dred Scott's legacy?
I hope they remember it as an encouragement, not only to study history, not only to get up and do something themselves and make a difference in the world, but to believe that all things are possible.
Thank you so much for sharing this moment with me. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
That's Lynn Jackson, the great-great-granddaughter of Dred and Harriet Scott, talking with STLPR's afternoon newscaster Marissa Ann Lewis-Thompson in 2023. They spoke at the Scott's final resting place in Calvary Cemetery at the then-new monument that honors their legacy. Producer Alex Hoyer spoke with Lynn Jackson this morning. She said she's thrilled that Dred and Harriet Scott have a permanent exhibit inside the newly renovated old courthouse.
For them to have their own gallery is just an incredible, huge honor and a great leap forward. There were days in my young youth years that their picture wasn't even on the wall. And then there was the black, I want to say it was plexiglass, maybe black plexiglass. They had two beautiful panels on the entrance off of Broadway for many years, but there really wasn't their story. Of course, they did the reenactments, but to get this gallery is amazing. And it will have a few aspects of their lives that people don't know about. So I'm thrilled about it.
What kind of aspects that people don't know about?
Ah, you want me to give it away, huh? Well, when he was in Fort Snelling, for instance, it's said by the curators and the people who give tours there. And by the way, Fort Snelling is in Minnesota, and that's where Dred and Harriet met and married. But Dr. Emerson, who quote-unquote owned him, sometimes they say perhaps Dred was able to help some of the patients when Dr. Emerson wasn't available. He did travel. He wasn't always at the fort. And they do have a picture in there of Dred assisting him. And so it seems as if he may have picked up a few tips on how to help people if they had medical issues.
That's Lynn Jackson, the great-great-granddaughter of Dred and Harriet Scott. She's also the founder and president of the Dred Scott Heritage Foundation. We need to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk about this Saturday's grand reopening of the old courthouse and what it took to get there. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio.
Support comes from Gemma, architects, planners, and designers seeking to bring joy to their clients and communities. Details at jemastl.com.
Welcome back. We're talking this hour about the grand reopening this Saturday of the old courthouse in downtown St. Louis. The landmark has been closed for renovations since 2020, and picturesque as it may be with its green dome and white columns, where it sits in front of the arch, it took a lot to get to this point. Here to talk about that, we have two guests. The first is Jeremy Sweat, superintendent of Gateway Arch National Park. The old courthouse is part of the park that's under the purview of the National Park Service. Jeremy, welcome to St. Louis on the Air.
Thanks for having me.
We also have Ryan McClure with us. He's the executive director of the Gateway Arch Park Foundation. That is the nonprofit conservancy that helps raise money for the National Park and other areas of downtown. Ryan, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So, Jeremy, I'd like to start with you. Earlier in the show, we heard from Lynn Jackson, the great-great-granddaughter of Dred and Harriet Scott. And as a reminder, Dred and Harriet Scott were enslaved people who sued for their freedom in St. Louis in the mid-1800s. It was a years-long legal battle that culminated in the U.S. Supreme Court concluding that people of African descent, whether they were free or enslaved, were not U.S. citizens and had no right to sue in federal court, and that they were considered legal property. The ruling helped push the United States closer to civil war. Jeremy, in what ways does the old courthouse acknowledge this history?
Yeah, so great question. The reason the old courthouse was included in a national park, the reason it is now owned by and paid for by all Americans, is that it is such a nationally significant part of our history. And so, as you mentioned, the court cases that happened there led directly to some really pivotal parts of our nation's history. So what it symbolizes is depends on who you ask, but it very much is a symbol of those times and those moments in our nation's history where we've fallen short of our own ideals, where mm-hmm. we've fallen short of that promise of equality and liberty for all Americans.
What did you make of what Lynn Jackson had to say earlier in our show about the courthouse and its significance? You said it is for everyone. Is there anything that stood out in what Lynn Jackson shared that you'd like to underscore?
I think her comment on reconciliation, we have come a long way in our society, but I think part of the story of the courthouse is that it is a symbol of the continued struggle for freedom, the continued struggle for equality, and we're still making progress as a nation to reconcile some of our past decisions and to find ways to provide the promise of freedom to everyone who lives here.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the past, we have talked about history, that is, and interpretation. With the renovation of the old courthouse, Jeremy, has the historical interpretation of Dred and Harriet Scott, has it changed?
It has, in a very powerful and positive way. So we've always had a focus on the Dred and Harriet Scott trial, but our old exhibit focused much more on the court case. This time around, everyone wanted to see the exhibit focus more on them as people.
Mm-hmm.
What was it like as a husband and wife, as parents, going through this legal process, and what were their lives like, to give us that deeper, richer understanding of who they were and what their role was in this case, not just as part of a legal case, but as humans.
Mm-hmm. Now, I had a chance this morning to tour the old courthouse, and it really is something to behold, especially I had mentioned, Jeremy, what it's like, to be in there when there are not many people apart from you and Ariel, who's with the foundation. One of the things I think that we sometimes forget is how much work goes into even starting work like that. And we talked earlier about the old courthouses closing in 2020. There must have been a great deal of work before that to prep for that work and its exhibits. Ryan, what and who did that involve?
Yeah, so this process really started in 2009. When the foundation was formed, and Gateway Arch Park Foundation is here specifically because we were going to help address some of the unique challenges that the park, that Gateway Arch National Park had approaching its 50th anniversary in 2015. So in terms of who was involved, it involved, nonprofits like Gateway Arch Park Foundation, the National Park Service, the City of St. Louis, the State of Missouri through MoDOT, Great Rivers Greenway, Bi-State Development, a lot. I mean, this was a huge public-private partnership to enact a $380 million full transformation of the Gateway Arch experience. So It still to this day is the largest public-private partnership in a national park project in history.
So that price tag that you mentioned, The old courthouse renovations are just part and actually the final phase of that $380 million project to enhance the Gateway Arch National Park grounds. That's a lot of money.
Yeah.
Why so much?
Well, I mean, to do what was needed at the Arch grounds, it took a lot of funding to do it. And 58% of that funding for the $380 million project was private funding. So donations to the foundation from St. Louis organizations, individuals, and foundations, which really speaks to how much people in St. Louis care about Gateway Arch National Park. But, you know, to fully renovate the museum, to expand the visitor center, to cap the highway so that the arch was physically connected to the city of St. Louis for the first time in its history. That's why it took that much money to make this happen. And that's just a few of the renovations.
Right. Well, related to money and also to any kind of construction or renovation, this all happened during the time of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. Were there pandemic-related issues that hampered, you know, progress, either Ryan or Jeremy?
Yeah, so Ryan was here for the design phase, if he wants to talk more about that. I think on the construction side, when I got here, we were still dealing very much with the impacts of the pandemic. So supply chain disruptions, labor market challenges. We had really significant inflation happening. And so our first time going out for bid for construction, we didn't get any bids. And we had to go back, get more realistic. And this is where that public-private partnership becomes so very important because we came up short and we didn't want to have a partial project or to lose so much of the value of that vision we had for the building. And so working with the Gateway Arch Park Foundation, me going back to Congress and my leadership and Ryan working with the state and his donors and his board, we were able to cobble together this very complicated mix of funding that helped us to carry out the full project.
Mm-hmm. And on the design front, was there anything, you know, that when visitors walk in, they might not know that there was a certain amount of work that went into it, but these are the results?
Yeah, you will both see many different things, and then there are different things about the building that you will never see. Mm-hmm. Trivers, the lead architect on this project, did a really great job with their team, and then Tarleton, the general contractor, in really modernizing this building, but protecting the historic fabric. So when you talk about the things people might not see, you now have central HVAC in the building. You have fire suppression, which is incredibly important to protect a building like this that is this important. So those are things you might not see, but really affect the visitor experience. All the windows are new, so
right.
We now have natural light flood. You probably saw that this morning.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Yeah, natural light flooding into the building, and you can see the city around you. Mm-hmm. I mean, and then, of course, what you will see right away is all these new exhibits, greater accessibility. There's an elevator for the first time in the building's history. There's just so much that we really want people to come in and see.
Yeah. So on that note of seeing it, the grand reopening celebration is this Saturday, and everything starts at 10 a.m. Can you give us a broad overview, Ryan, of what is going to happen?
Sure. I would love to. We really want our entire community and our visitors to come down Saturday, May 3rd, starting at 10 a.m. will be the ribbon cutting, and we'll have lots of dignitaries there. The In Unison Choir will be performing. Then immediately following the ribbon cutting, starting at 11 a.m., we're going to have a big community festival in Keener Plaza right mm-hmm. next to the courthouse. So we'll have performances by Brian Owens. Kababi Bayok will be there, and I know mm-hmm. he, you know, we're going to talk about the great branding that he created for this. Lynn Jackson will be there. And then Jennifer Lewis, award-winning St. Louis-born actress, will be there as well. So it's going to be a wonderful festival from 11 to 3 p.m. Mm-hmm. on Saturday, and we really hope everybody comes down and celebrates this monumental occurrence.
And that festival is called Journey to Justice. And
that's right.
The theme and visual identity was created by someone you've just mentioned, yeah. St. Louis artist Kababi Bayok. And our producer, Alex Hoyer, had a chance to talk with Kababi this morning.
People will see visually, even upon approaching the courthouse, they have banners and there's a lot of color. So even Dredd and Harriet Scott have color in their clothing. I mean, there's some photos that have been used forever that are very, you know, kind of bland, very historical. But this time I was asked to use some of the same patterns, polka dot stripes, hatch marks that I use in some of my artwork, and use those in the clothing of Dredd and Harriet Scott.
Now, artist Kababi Bayok's designs are also featured in a new video that'll be part of the permanent Dredd and Harriet Scott exhibit at the Old Courthouse. Now, Jeremy, you are the superintendent of Gateway Arch National Park, and in late February, an employee at the park who wanted to remain anonymous out of fear of retribution told STLPR's Abby Larico that employees there felt terrorized by the Trump administration's cuts and that they were layoffs. Against that backdrop, and you know, given the stress that comes with grand openings of any sort, are you feeling prepared?
We are very prepared for the grand opening of the old courthouse, and we are looking forward to it. Beyond that, I cannot say anything about any staffing decisions or any executive actions.
Mm-hmm. Ryan, you are the primary fundraiser for Gateway Arch National Park. You gave us some numbers, very large numbers. How does uncertainty around federal funding influence your work?
Well, in a couple of ways. I mean, we are very fortunate because we are completely privately funded. So everything that all of the private funding that goes into the old courthouse and goes into the park, that's all privately raised. So there's no federal funding there. I also have the honor of serving as the board chair for the National Park Friends Alliance, which is all the organizations like ours around the country. I can tell you that we're all very concerned about the staffing changes that we're seeing at the National Park Service. And all of us are advocating for fully staffed parks so that the visitor experience remains excellent as it has for years. And to raise money and implement private funding at parks, you need National Park Service staff to implement what donors are supporting. Mm-hmm. So all of us in friends groups are pretty concerned and advocating for, fully staffed parks.
Mm-hmm. Now, Jeremy, to return to the history, we've talked about Dredd and Harriet Scott. But the old courthouse is also notable as the site of a major case involving Virginia Minor and women's rights. What was that case, briefly, and how is it acknowledged in the courthouse?
Yeah, so Virginia Minor is one of those. There's a lot of really important civil rights history, but that's one of the other big cases because it did go all the way to the Supreme Court, but started there in the old courthouse. And so Virginia Minor, after the 14th Amendment was passed, granting the right to vote to U.S. citizens, she asserted that women were citizens and should have the right to vote. And that decision was appealed to the Supreme Court, who ruled against her, and it would be half a century before some women would have the right to vote. It would, of course, be until the Civil Rights Act was passed in the 1960s before all women had the equal right to vote. As far as how we acknowledge it, we've got a panel, a really well-done panel there, but I think our vision, and I'm going to look at Ryan and say our joint vision between the Park Service and the Foundation is that that case deserves more, and the story of women's rights and women's suffrage deserves more. So at some point in the future, we'd like to explore having a standalone gallery that focuses on not just the Virginia Minor trial, but that trial in the context of the larger fight for women's suffrage.
Mm-hmm. Now, we have just about a minute left. Ryan, is there a part of this grand reopening you're most excited about?
I am excited for the personal experiences that people will have. This building has been closed for 5 years, a building that is so important to the history of not just St. Louis, but of our country. And we want to make sure that St. Louisans and our visitors get to experience it. And what I look forward to is when I get to go in the building and see families, friends, young and old, experiencing this and seeing themselves in this history, and knowing, you know, that that's what we're here for, mm-hmm. is to create those memories and lasting impact for generations.
Mm-hmm. Jeremy Sweat is superintendent of Gateway Arch National Park, and Ryan McClure is executive director of Gateway Arch Park Foundation. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The historic old courthouse reopens to the public this Saturday. You can find information about the Journey to Justice Festival at archpark.org.
Today's episode was produced by our executive producer, Alex Hoyer.
Audio engineering and podcast design by Aaron Dorr.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thanks.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri St. Louis.
The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.